Today we'll revisit ethical exif by looking at a sea eagle safari, Ryan wonders about lens resolution, and Tom has questions about the new full-frame mirrorless lens mounts and about what their bigger diameter and reduced flange distance mean for future lenses. This is Tips from the Top Floor, episode 841 for Thursday, September the 20th, 2018.
Tips from the top floor, tips from the top, all right.
Hey, hello, welcome. I've completely forgotten how to record an episode because, yeah, I've just returned from Ireland and Lofoten. I think, I did record one after Ireland. So you heard that, but yeah, I'm just back from Norway. And that was my third time there, the second time with a photo tour. And I know I've said in the past that I won't go back to the same place more than once, but let me say it this way. There is a good chance that I'll go back with a group of photographers to Lofoten, maybe in 2020. Not sure yet, but I simply love that place. The landscapes, the seascapes, the way the land and the sea interact, the weather, the light, the people, the food. Oh, man. If you love fish, you'll be in heaven. And if you're not a fan of fish, there are alternatives that are equally good. Or you might discover your love for fish there. Anyway, photography-wise, it was all that we had wished for. Great weather almost throughout. We had several nights with auroras, the northern lights. And just in general, I mean, it was a fun group to be with people from Germany, Canada, Thailand, China, Israel. And it's just a great and diverse group. It was a real pleasure to be with all of you, and there are photos online that I will link in the show notes. So it was an overall success. Really nice group, great photography. But of course, I want to mix it up when I go back to a place. I always kind of want to mix it up, do something new, do something different. So yeah, I'm thinking about going back in 2020 in winter time. Because Lofoten, every season I've been there so far, in the midsummer, in the fall, every season has their advantages. It's right at the edge of the Arctic. It's right in the Arctic, which makes for just amazing light up there. And in winter, the landscape is just very different. And so it was really, really good. It was a lot of fun. One thing, though, that came up there that I want to talk about here is a follow-up to something I said in a previous episode about ethical exif. You might remember that animal photography and how it might be, at least fair to the viewer to disclose what went on when you took a picture of animals, of how you treated them, what, how really wild and natural the whole thing was. And we did a sea eagle safari in Svolvær in Lofoten, which is spectacular. I mean, first of all, it's a lot of fun because you are in a speedboat and you go out to different fjords that are that are just, yeah, mind-blowingly beautiful. Again, the landscape, I'll check out the links in the show notes to the photos so you get an idea. But then, I mean, that's the entire purpose of that thing. It's called a sea eagle safari. The captain stops at a few different spots where he knows there are eagles out there, sea eagles in the wild. And then you want to get those sea eagles close to the ship, to the boat, to be able to photograph them, because that was why we went there. And so, of course, what they do is they start to throw fish into the water. Just one, you know, in a bucket, the bucket on board, and then throw fish in the water to get the sea eagles to come out. And it's not even initially to attract the sea eagles. First and foremost, it's to attract the seagulls, because they then make a ruckus, and then the eagle gets alerted. And then the eagle comes to check out the situation. And just, I mean, if you have an eagle flying around the boat, hovering in the wind, That is majestic, very majestic animals, especially when they fly close to you. That is really quite something to see. And of course, those sea eagle safaris, and that's where the kind of the ethical exif part comes in. They are businesses, right? They do several tours a day. So the eagles have, of course, over time learned that when there is a boat with several yellow dots in it, which would be us with the flotation suits on, then there will be a snack. That's, of course, the case. The eagles know that, and then they hopefully come and fetch the snack. And it also means the eagle will then get somewhat close to the boat, because that's where the fish floats in the water. And it will try to grab that dead fish that's floating in the water. And that's pretty much the moment that most photographers will be looking for. When the eagle scoops down, grabs the fish, and then flies away with the fish in its claws. And we got some really cool shots there. But a little sidebar, eagles cannot swim. Yep, that's eagles can't swim. If they fall into the water, if they make a mistake and if they fall in the water, if they're close enough to the shore, they might be able to get to the shore to sort of swim a bit. But if they're too far away, there is a good chance that they will drown because the feathers will get soaked in water. And the eagles are not ducks. They're really cautious before they dive for the fish. They will do several rounds to make sure they approach the fish against the wind. And the younger ones, the younger eagles, are much more cautious than the older ones, who are way more experienced. And it's a really interesting little sidebar. But from an ethical exif point of view, of course you don't see any of that in the photos. The fish throwing and the boat being near with, I don't know, 10 people watching. So what looks like wildlife isn't quite as wild as it seems. But still, I mean, the photos are great. And it kind of almost feels a bit like a symbiosis between the human and the animal. And both sides kind of get something out of it. I mean, the humans get photos and amazing experiences and business from it. While the eagles get a few free snacks a day. And they are better protected because, of course, those businesses want to protect the value, their ability to keep doing sea eagle safaris. So they will certainly make sure that no one goes out after those eagles. Now, again, this can be seen from many different angles, and this is just one of them. And I'm pretty sure there are a few out there who have a different opinion. And here's one more interesting thing, one experience that made it pretty clear to me how much of a symbiosis this is. Because at one of the stops, there was an eagle sitting in a tree at the shore. I didn't first see it, and then the captain pointed out, "Look there, there's the eagle." And then the captain did what he does. He tried, like, he waved the fish in the air, and then he throws it in the water, but the eagle just won't move. It was just sitting there. And I guess it's probably not hungry, because maybe it had already been fed a couple of times by other ships in the morning. So, there are several companies there that offer those sea eagle safaris. So it's not unlikely that the eagle was just sitting there going, "Burp, I'm full." But then the captain did something that I initially didn't really understand. He scooped the dead fish out of the water and put it back in the bucket before we left that spot. And the reason for that, he explained it to me, is that the sea eagles are, I mean, they are kind of wild animals after all. I mean, they do have rings on their legs, so they have been, like, counted and measured and whatever they do with eagles before they put them back in the wild. But they are wild animals. They live out there in the mountains, and they know that, oh, there's the 10 yellow dots. I will get a snack. So, but of course, they would prefer to eat that fish without a boat full of humans nearby, right? So the eagles, over time, they've learned that if they only wait long enough, the humans will give up and leave. But the fish is still in the water, and then they have all the time in the world to go for that fish. So there's a learning process. These things are smart. So by scooping up the fish and taking it with us, that was a training measure. So the eels learn that they'll only get the fish if there's a boat nearby, and they won't wait for us to leave. And on the one hand, that is really funny. But on the other hand, when we were out there, I thought that would be a really perfect thing to talk about here in the show in the context of ethical exif. So let me know if you have an opinion on that. Let me know what you think about this. You can send me an email or send me your thoughts in your own voice. That's, you know, that's what I prefer. I love to hear your voices here on the show. Go to tfttf.com/voice. tfttf.com/voice. And tell me what you think. Let me say a quick thank you to this week's sponsor, Vistaprint. Being prepared when an opportunity comes up is crucial, and having a business card ready to go in your pocket is the first step to making something happen. With Vistaprint, you can create a truly professional, unique card in minutes. And I tried this myself and it works. The quality is great. You upload your own design or start with one of their professionally designed options. Vistaprint offers simple tools and a wide range of templates to choose from. Then you pick a paper stock, style, and the quantity that's right for you. Choose your delivery speed and then order and receive your cards in as few as 3 days. Your next big opportunity is coming right now, and for as little as $10, you can feel ready to make an impression with a custom card that you choose. With Vistaprint, you can look and feel like the big deal, whether you're a startup or a business with a century of history. And Vistaprint wants you to do something great for your business right now, which is why all the listeners of Tips from the Top Floor will get 500 high-quality custom business cards starting at $9.99. All you have to do is go to vistaprint.com and use code TOPFLOOR. That's code TOPFLOOR at vistaprint.com. TOPFLOOR at vistaprint.com. Thanks for the support.
Hey Chris, this is Ryan from Las Vegas, and I got a quick question for you. So from time to time, I'll hear people talk about a lens not being able to resolve a certain amount of pixels, or at least that's what I think they're saying, but I've never really known what that means. Are there differences in the amount of light that can pass through various lenses? Do certain sensors require more light to be able to properly capture an image? Wanted to get your thoughts on this. Thanks, love the show.
Hey Ryan, thank you so much for your voicemail. By the way, everyone else, go and record your questions right now. Put this show on pause if you have a question about photography. I love hearing your voice on the show, and you can send that to voice at tfttf.com or go to tfttf.com/voice for instructions how to get stuff here. Yeah, okay, back to Ryan. Lens resolution. Yeah, I'm making these noises for a reason. I'm not a specialist for lens resolution, but there are a few of my thoughts. I believe the term lens resolution is not kind of an official term. It's more of a marketing thing. But in general, what this means is pretty much the precision of the image that the lens does. The sharpness of the lens, if you will. Let's do a little thought experiment, right? You put a lens in a controlled environment, put it on a stand, let's say a little lab with a test chart, and you point it at a test chart at a defined brightness and like lab conditions, okay? And then you attach camera A to that lens and you find out how good the overall system is in terms of resolution. And there are clear ways to do that. In the end, there's like a value in line pairs that comes out. There are like test charts. Let me explain that. Test charts that have lines on them. Little zebra stripes, and if you can clearly distinguish between like two adjacent black and white lines, again zebra crossings, the line pair still resolves that, and then that there are multiple of these little zebra stripes on those test charts at different sizes, so you'll kind of get to a point where you cannot distinguish between the two adjacent lines, and that's the resolution of the overall system. And then you would leave that lens in place and take the camera off, take camera A off and attach camera B that has more megapixels, and you do the same test. And now you'll see that, like, if you can distinguish between more of the little zebra stripe line pairs, the smaller ones, then the whole system has a higher resolution. And so you kind of end up with the maximum resolution for that specific system. And if you end up with the same maximum resolution on like different megapixel cameras with the same, but if they have the same sensor size but different megapixels, then that probably means that the lens is the limiting factor. So in that context, you would say, okay, that's the resolution of the lens. That's how much it can resolve. Because yeah, the glass, the lenses are made by people. They're in a manufacturing process and there are tolerances and there are like, it can only go so sharp. And making sharper lenses is more expensive because you have to be more precise when making them. But now, let me try to make you worry a bit less about that. Because, I mean, yeah, let's try to get away from the pixel peeping. You know I'm not a fan of that. Because honestly, lens resolution, and I'm putting this in air quotes here, has never ever been a limiting factor in my photography. Not a single time. In how many tens of years I've been doing this. I shot with old lenses, with new lenses, with third-party lenses, with manual focus lenses, with lenses that have been adapted from other systems. And what makes photography great is not the detail sharpness. Never is. Unless you're a scientist and you do scientific photography. But I guess most of you who listen to this are not. You want to make art. You want to tell stories. It's not how many line pairs a lens in a camera system can resolve. What makes photography great is what's in the photo, what emotion that photo evokes, what stories you tell with the photo. So the lens resolution and a whole bunch of other technical factors are the last thing that I will think about when taking a photo. It's just not important.
Hi, Chris. Hey, this is Tom from Minnesota with a question for you. This question is about lens mounts. As everybody's probably heard, Nikon just announced the new line of mirrorless cameras with the new Z mount. Nikon's had the F mount for almost 6 years now. I guess it came out back in 1959. Question I have for you is, I know that the Z mount is wider and it has a shorter flange distance between, I guess, the, you know, where the mount is and where the sensor is. And having spent a number of years in high tech, and I know you did as well. I know that engineers and management teams and all that don't make big changes like that without a really good reasons. So I'm just curious what your thoughts are about conceivably what having this wider mount and that shorter flange distance, what kind of things does that make possible that weren't possible with the old F mount? That is my question. Thanks, and keep up the good work, and I hope you're having a great time in, I think you're in Norway now, so have a great time. Bye.
Thanks, Tom. So yeah, lens mounts. And of course, yeah, that question was triggered by the new full-frame offering of Nikon, the mirrorless full-frame, and the Canon now, the Canon EOS R and the Nikon Z6 and 7. Z or Z? Anyway, you know what I mean. So far, if you wanted a full-frame camera without the mirror box, you had to go Leica or Sony, pretty much. And not everyone is willing to pay Leica prices. So a lot of people flock to Sony with their A7 and the A7S and the A7R models. And Sony had those out beginning at the end of 2013. So that's like 5 years now that they've been on the market. And both Nikon and Canon, they've been losing customers to Sony for 5 years. And so the popularity of the Sony system, the Sony full-frame mirrorless system, has hurt Canon and Nikon. Nikon, again, you know what I mean. So they now have both announced their own full-frame mirrorless systems. The Nikon Z6-7 and the Canon EOS R. And I'm deliberately calling those systems, not just cameras, because they also come with new lens mounts. They both announced a new lens mount, the Nikon Z or Z mount and the Canon R mount. And this is a big deal for the manufacturers. They have done, I'm not even sure how long, but Nikon has done their F mount forever and Canon has done their EF mount and later the EFS mount for a long time. Now, I don't really want to go into into like the general pros and cons of mirror versus mirrorless. There's plenty of information about that online, and I'm highly biased anyway, being a mirror shooter myself. But let me instead answer Tom's questions. He asked what the flange distance difference of mirrorless versus mirror cameras means, and also what kind of advantages the bigger mount diameters bring to the table. And let's begin with the diameter first. Now, the lens mount obviously has an inner diameter. That's the maximum thing that you can push light through, and Nikon, the Z mount is 55 millimeters in diameter, whereas their old F mount was 44 millimeters, and the Canon R mount is 54 millimeters, like 1 millimeter smaller than Nikon, but that doesn't really make a difference, and their old EF mount was 46 millimeters, or is 46, they're still announcing new lenses for that, so these new mounts will, at least not for quite a while, replace the old mounts. So they both added about a centimeter, 0.4 inches, roughly, to their lens mounts. And, the lens mounts are interesting because, I mean, let's look at the bigger mount sizes, first of all. The bigger mount allows bigger glass. And what I mean with that is the lenses with a bigger diameter. And that results in making it easier to build brighter lenses or more precise lenses. And those are both tightly connected, the precision and the brightness. We'll get to that in a minute. And second, the bigger mount also means that, in case of the Nikon Z series, at least, that the sensor can move. They have IBIS, in-body image stabilization. So the thing that many of the Micro Four Thirds cameras already have, where you don't need the image stabilizer in the lens, but instead you can put it in the camera and the sensor moves and stabilizes the image. And in general, the bigger mount, Canon doesn't do that, by the way, not yet, but anyway, in general, that allows you as a lens manufacturer, designer, allows you more freedom to design lenses. Now, at this point, someone will bring up Leica. Because obviously brighter glass, brighter lenses are possible with smaller mounts. If we look at the Leica M mount, it is 44 millimeters in diameter. That's a centimeter or 0.4 inches smaller than the new mounts. But they do have a lens called the Noctilux. It's a 50 millimeter lens. It goes down to f0.95 and it works just fine. So why can't the others do that? Well, they kind of could, but making a smaller lens at the right level of precision needs a lot more optical manufacturing precision than bigger ones. In general, I mean that's a golden rule of manufacturing. To make a small thing, you will need tighter tolerances than if you make a big thing. And of course, with bigger glass, that means they can manufacture those lenses with bigger glass, the bright lenses with bigger glass, without having such tight tolerances that it drives up the price too much. And then bigger glass, I mean, of course, also bigger diameters of those lens elements in your camera will have the chance to make the lenses more heavy. So there's a drawback here. But that's generally the mount diameter. It allows you bigger glass, brighter lenses at a price point that is still doable. That's one of the reasons why Leica is so expensive, because their optical quality with the smaller diameter lens elements has to be so good. What I find more interesting is the flange distance. That is the distance between the lens mount and the sensor. And it's kind of defined per camera system. If you enter flange distance in Wikipedia, you get a whole list of different cameras with their flange distances. And example, pretty extreme example, is Mamiya. The Mamiya RB67, it's a medium format camera, has a flange distance of 111 millimeters. That's almost 4.4 inches. Which is crazy, right? So, yeah, the flange distance of the Canon R system, they're about 2 centimeters. They're much, much shorter. And the reason is because with cameras with a mirror box, DSLRs, single lens reflex. Reflex means it's reflected of a mirror. So that's where the mirror comes in. With the mirror box, with the mirror being able to swing out of the way, they just are bigger. The cameras are bigger because they need to leave space for the mirror, right? So the shorter flange distance, first and foremost, makes the camera smaller. And doesn't do that in width. It does maybe do that a little in height, as like the viewfinder is now electronic and it might need less space there. You don't need a prism on top of the camera. But where you as a camera manufacturer save space is in the depth axis, front to back. Those cameras are thinner because they ditch the mirror box. And now here's where the shorter flange distance of mirrorless cameras comes in really handy, because there are many lenses out there that are designed to have a larger flange distance, or at least larger than their mirrorless counterparts. And that in turn enables adaption of those older lenses to the mirrorless cameras. And it makes it very easy to do so in the simplest case, even without having to introduce any additional lenses, any glass, any additional optical elements. All that the adapter has to do is to recreate that flange distance. And that's the flange distance of the lens. The lens was designed for a flange distance. So in its simplest case, the adapter could be purely mechanical, right? Just a distance ring between the DSLR lens and the mirrorless camera. With manual lenses, like manual focus and aperture lenses, that's exactly the case. That's all you need. Now, if the lens expects some communication, let's say for setting focus and aperture and image stabilizer and stuff like that, then the adapter needs to also provide the according contacts on both sides, so the camera can talk to the lens and maybe they possibly have a circuit in the middle to do some translation. But that's pretty much what their adapters do. So both of their mirrorless systems, the Nikon Z system and the Canon R system, bring an adapter. I'm not sure if they come with an adapter in the box, but you can get a different adapters even in some cases to adapt your old lenses to them. So that's a fairly simple thing. And in general, that's one advantage of the new mirrorless systems. With their shorter flange distances, with the right adapter, you can adapt almost all other lenses. Now, of course, I would say that's not everything. I mean, only soit qui mal y pense, or shame to him who evil thinks, but a new camera system with a new mount will, of course, probably also not hurt their future camera and lens sales. So there's that. So, ethics in wildlife photography and new lens mounts. Anything you want to add, shoot me a voicemail for one of the next episodes. Go to tfttf.com/voice to find out more. tfttf.com/voice. I want to hear from you. If you like the episode, let me know by giving the show a rating on iTunes or by supporting it in any other way. There's Patreon, there's word of mouth. I'm just very grateful for all your support, and every bit helps. More at tfttf.com/support. That's tfttf.com/support. Thank you. Music for the show by Jeff Smith, Silent Partner, Headspitter, Gagwood Publishing, and Slack Challenges by Release Pixie, Matt Rassiter, Armstead, Slack Invitations by Chief Invitations Officer, CIO Rusty Russ. The link to get on the Slack is in the show notes. My name is Chris Marquardt. You'll find me on social media, including Mastodon at Chris, MarquardT. I remember that I told you there'd be sun. Now go out and take amazing photos. And I told you there'd be laughter after pain. As always, be nice to each other. You said it ain't as easy as it seems. And of course, happy shooting.